Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, May 9, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we speak with Texas Attorney General Kenneth Paxton about the Exxon investigation. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear, as is our custom, opening remarks from our guest today of about 5 to 8, 10 minutes. And then, as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please be thinking of those questions for when we get to that portion of the program. In order to get as much time with our guests as possible, let me introduce and thank in advance the Honorable Ken Paxton, Attorney General of Texas, for joining us. General Paxton, the floor is yours.
Hey, I appreciate it, Dean. I hope you guys are having a good day. Let me start off by just giving you a little history on how this all got going with Exxon. Obviously, Exxon is headquartered in Texas, and so we've been paying attention to this from the beginning. This all started in January with supposedly a secret meeting among activists dealing with climate change, suggesting that they were going to, in some way, start trying to find ways to aggressively pursue companies like Exxon. And sure enough, they held true to that, and there was a press conference in March with former Vice President Al Gore, many of the AGs from mostly Democratic states, including Eric Schneiderman. So that press conference came off, and shortly thereafter, in April, Exxon, after hearing of subpoenas being issued, criminal subpoenas being issued by the Virgin Islands, oddly enough, for 40 years of records from Exxon, they actually filed in state district court in Tarrant County, which is Fort Worth, basically moving to attack these or quash these subpoenas. We actually decided to intervene in May, largely on two grounds. One is free speech. We felt like this was a speech issue and that the company had every right to express any opinion they wanted about climate change or any other issue, and that this was a First Amendment case. We also had issues with the Virgin Islands basically referring this case over to a law firm to get a contingency fee to potentially prosecute Exxon, which we found to be a potential violation of due process. So those were our two claims we filed in May. The Virgin Islands moved to have the case brought into federal court, transferred to federal court, removed to federal court. That occurred. In June, a couple of things happened. Exxon filed for declaratory judgment and an injunction in federal district court in Texas, again in the Tarrant County area. That one related to Massachusetts and stopping their subpoenas. At the same time, that occurred approximately in the same week. The Virgin Islands, after just a short stint in Texas, decided that their fishing expedition would be better served by going back to the Virgin Islands as opposed to fishing in Texas. So they left the state and they withdrew their case. So that one was done actually rather expeditiously, so we were pleased about our intervention there. Later that summer, New York was added to the Exxon filing in federal district court in Texas. And I think it was around November that they started both Massachusetts and New York started asking for a transfer to either New York or Massachusetts. Ultimately, it was transferred in March of this year. That case was transferred to the Southern District of New York. And we filed, along with 10 other states, an amicus brief in that case in April. So that's how we found our way into the case, really along similar lines. I want to give you a little factual background on the case and go through a few of the facts. The facts underlying the case stand out as an unfortunate example of the misuse of the prosecutorial power to chill one side of a public policy debate. And let's review some of the most salient, undisputed, and disturbing facts. Announcing the subpoenas, defendants declared in a press release that their investigation is the product of a cultural movement committed to aggressively protecting and building upon the recent progress the United States has made in combating climate change. Similarly, at a press conference called to publicize the investigations, defendants calling themselves, quote, AGs United for Clean Power, close quote, characterized their effort as the beginning of the end of our addiction to fossil fuel and the degradation of our planet. Former Vice President Al Gore alleged that commercial interests, such as Exxon, are committing fraud in their communications. Judge Kincaid, who is a federal district judge initially involved in this case, transferred the lawsuit again to the Southern District of New York, and he described the press release as follows. Attorney General Healey, Attorney General Schneiderman, several other states' attorneys general, and former President Al Gore, Vice President Al Gore, spoke at the AGs United for Clean Power press conference. At that press conference, the attorneys general spoke about the negative effects of climate change and the importance of taking action in the fight against climate change. Attorney General Schneiderman reminded everyone of his ongoing investigation of Exxon, and Attorney General Healey reiterated that companies in the fossil fuel industry, such as Exxon, must be held accountable for deceiving investors and the public. Attorney General Healey stated that there was a troubling disconnect between what Exxon knew about climate change and what Exxon told investors and the public regarding climate change. Judge Kincaid also described defendants' campaign to delegitimize Exxon as a political actor. The court wrote that in January 2016, according to emails discussing the planning of the meeting, attorneys and activists met at the offices of the Rockefeller Family Fund in New York City, New York, to discuss goals of an Exxon campaign which sought to delegitimize Exxon as a political actor and to force officials to disassociate themselves with Exxon. According to Judge Kincaid, the following things occurred. In the emails discussing the planning of the meeting at the Rockefeller Family Fund provided to the court, the goals of the Exxon campaign are to establish in the public's mind that Exxon is a corrupt institution that has pushed humanity and all creation towards climate chaos and grave harm. Second, to establish in the public mind that Exxon is a corrupt institution that has pushed humanity, I just said that one, to delegitimize Exxon as a political actor, to force officials to disassociate themselves from Exxon, their money, and their historic opposition to climate progress, for example, by refusing campaign donations, refusing to take meetings, calling for a price on carbon. Next, to call into question climate advantages of fracking compared to coal. Next, to drive disinvestment from Exxon, and finally, to drive Exxon and climate change into the center of the 2016 election cycle. Furthermore, Mr. Matthew Pawa, that's how you say his name, an attorney and climate change activist, and Mr. Peter Frumhoff, a climate change activist and a director of science and policy at the Union of Concerned Science, presented to the attorneys general. In 2012, Mr. Pawa presented at a workshop organized by Mr. Frumhoff, which discussed, among other things related to climate change, the viability of diverse strategies, including the legal merits of targeting carbon producers as opposed to carbon emitters, for U.S.-focused climate mitigation and strategies to win access to internal documents of fossil fuel companies. The draft agenda of defendants' meeting with Messrs. Pawa and Frumhoff stated that the meeting would include presentations on the imperative of taking action now on a climate change, presented by Mr. Frumhoff, and a climate change litigation, presented by Mr. Pawa. To conceal the coordinated nature of defendants' intended censorship, Mr. Pawa emailed the Office of the New York Attorney General to ask how he should respond if asked by a reporter from the Wall Street Journal whether he attended the closed-door meeting with the Attorneys General. The Office of the New York Attorney General responded by instructing Mr. Pawa to not confirm that you attended or otherwise discussed the event. These actions are the hallmark of an organized campaign to engage in an unconstitutional viewpoint discrimination and to chill speech. So that kind of fundamentally addresses some of the facts. There's certainly more going on than just that. But at this point, Dean, I'll just open it up for questions if anybody has any questions about our amicus and kind of where we're at.
Well, thank you very much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Attorney General Ken Paxton, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we have one question pending, then our lines are wide open, so push the star button, then pound button. With that, let's go to our first caller.
Mr. Attorney General, thank you. My name is Chris Warner with the Competitive Enterprise Institute and Energy and Environment Legal Institute. I obtained that PAWA email you were mentioning, among many others, showing the origin of this scheme. Among the documents that the New York OAG is withholding from us in litigation are correspondence before and contemporaneous with their subpoena with activists and major party donors. And they're withholding them as law enforcement under the law enforcement privilege, obviously, because privileges that can be waived would have been waived by corresponding with Tom Steyer's executive assistant or the Rockefeller Family Fund. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on this. Because we have emails going back to months before a subpoena from Mr. Frumhoff, who you mentioned, to someone else in the faculty lounge saying, hey, we're working on something with AGs, showing that they were involved at an early stage. This idea of working with donors and activists and then withholding it as law enforcement to keep it privileged, I'm curious about any thoughts you have on that.
Well, you know, obviously we have a careful balance between protecting law enforcement from doing their investigation and not having that subject to any kind of open records or even litigation discovery. However, in this case, it certainly seems like they potentially waive that by working with outside forces on a policy position as opposed to a real law enforcement issue. So I think we're maybe in somewhat uncharted territory here in addressing issues that we haven't seen much of in the past, because this effort by the AGs is certainly not something I've ever seen before. And so it brings to bear questions that we haven't had to deal with. So, you know, I'm always cautious to say that, you know, law enforcement has to turn over information that they're using in their investigation, but at the same time, there needs to be a balance here, and I don't know exactly what that appropriate balance is, but there needs to be a balance here to providing information if it really is a political issue, which I think we've, you know, somewhat demonstrated is actually happening. So in this case, I'd certainly lean towards it. They would have to be required to turn it over.
Thank you. Are you their recruiting letter, by the way, that we obtained from various OAGs in March, I think March 7th of 2016, expressly stated their reason for organizing, and it was to make the promises made in Paris reality. So I think they affirmed in their own words in recruiting their coalition that it was a political campaign using law enforcement office and now seeking to cloak their correspondence with outside activists as law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think I lean as we're talking about this towards requiring that they turn this over, because there doesn't really seem to be a real law enforcement aspect to this. This is more about political change and by the force of you know, law enforcement, we're going to change your minds and we're going to force you to have a different opinion on this issue.
Thank you.
Attorney General, this is Dean Reuter. Are those documents something that the court could review and figure out itself in camera, whether they should be turned over or not, whether they're subject to that privilege?
You know what? It's interesting because I don't actually know the answer, but I would certainly request that of the judge, and I don't know why at this point that wouldn't be a good starting point to determine whether these documents need to be turned over.
Very good. Once again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines are wide open. Let's take another call.
Hello, Attorney General. When the United States couldn't prosecute Al Capone, they got creative and went to tax evasion, and that's famously how he ended up going to prison, notwithstanding all the other nefarious deeds he had done. It sounds to me like some citizens may have come to these attorney generals with a suggestion for prosecution for material violations of security laws. And I don't think you as an attorney general would want to dissuade citizens from coming forward with complaints against lawbreakers. What I'm trying to figure out here is, where's the free speech claim? Because I'm sure you don't want public companies lying in their press releases and other official documents about anything of a material sort. Where is the case, and what is wrong with working with citizens to prosecute evildoers?
Well, I don't want anybody lying, not you, not Exxon, not anybody. So what it appeared to us, look, you know, if there are securities issues that need to be dealt with, then they need to be dealt with. But we'll see how that turns out. To me, it looks like just another angle on going after them for their positions on climate change and the fact that their business basically emits carbon. So, and that's certainly what it looked like to us. It didn't look like a legitimate securities issue. It certainly didn't start out that way. It seems like it's morphed into that because this climate change idea that the Virgin Islands started with and New York and Massachusetts have proceeded with has not been very successful. It certainly wasn't in district court in Texas at its beginning, and it wasn't with the Virgin Islands. So to me, it looks like another angle for them to go after Exxon. Look, if they have legitimate securities issues, that maybe should be the SEC, and they should look at it, but not to abuse them just because they have a difference of opinion. And certainly we don't want government in the business of investigating people because they have a different opinion about climate change.
Can I ask your opinion on the tobacco prosecutions? Do you think that was legitimate, or do you think the doctors that were lying before Congress and the CEOs were exercising their First Amendment rights, and they've got a right to lie to the American public about what causes cancer?
Honestly, I'm the wrong person to ask. The tobacco litigation mostly occurred before I came into office. Our settlements were all pretty much resolved and done before I came into office.
Is there an analogy, though, there?
I don't know the details of tobacco, so I'm not going to comment.
Thanks.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines are open. Let's take another call.
This is John Meyer, and my question is, Competitive Enterprise Institute was originally the other target of this litigation, or at least of some of the cases. What is their status now? Have they ceased to be a target, or are they still a target of this prosecution?
I don't know specifically, and maybe Dean, you know the answer, but I fear at this point any group like that takes a lead on climate change is, if not continuing target now, certainly if this is successful, they will be a target in the future.
Well, that's about right. This is Dean Reuter. That my understanding is CEI was served with a subpoena by the Virgin Islands Attorney General. CEI contested it with the help of the Baker-Hostetler law firm and its partner, Andrew Grossman, and prevailed to the extent that the Virgin Islands Attorney General withdrew the request for documents. And these are, I think, CEI was subject to a document request that wasn't quite as sweeping as the document request. I shouldn't say request. It was a subpoena that they hit Exxon with, which, as the Attorney General mentioned, went back 40 years, and even longer than 40 years, as I understand it. When I read the subpoena, it included documents back to the 1970s or documents that were existence in the 1970s that were created even before then if their policies held over to the 1970s. So you could have a personnel manual, for example, created in 1965, still in effect in 1975, that was subject to production. In any event, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. While we wait to see if somebody else rings in, Attorney General, let me ask you, you mentioned the contingency fee aspect of this and the due process violation, noting that the Virgin Islands Attorney General had retained outside counsel on a contingency fee basis. I got a personal opinion on this I won't share, but I'm interested in the due process violation angle there, if you could say more about that.
Well, so in our country, we've always discouraged, and largely constitutional basis, prosecutions that are based on financial incentives. The last thing we want in this country is people being prosecuted because there's money to be made, and so you end up, in my opinion, you end up violating people's due process rights if you incentivize a prosecution. And in this case, the Virgin Islands clearly was doing that by offering a contingency fee based on success rather than a prosecution based on, you know, the merits of the case and ultimately justice. So obviously a huge concern when you're talking about subjecting people to potential criminal liability, whether it's, you know, misdemeanor or felony. It obviously has a dramatic impact on the lives of people that are dealing with that. And so we're very sensitive to those issues in my office, and I know that that's true for many of the AGs that signed on to this, that was a one of the primary concerns we had with the strategy that they were willing to use, you know, financial resources to go after people.
Very good. Let me make another call for questions. Our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We have another question at this point, so let's turn now to our next caller.
General Paxton, is there any precedent for either a state or a federal court to issue an injunction against a state attorney general from conducting an investigation?
I'm not aware necessarily of any. There may be examples of it, but off the top of my head, I don't have one. The reason this is sort of egregious, one of the things that the judge, Ed Kincaid, concluded as he was making the transfer is that, you know, the standard is fairly high for a court to step in and take action, and the standard is bad faith. And the judge made a fairly decent case that what was going on here with Massachusetts and New York was the facts essentially led him to conclude that there might be bad faith occurring here. And so in our amicus, we kind of cover some of that at the end of our brief, suggesting that while the standard is high, there is a standard, and that because we believe that there's bad faith going on here, that allows the federal courts to continue to review this and potentially take action.
Thank you.
Sure. Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I don't know, Attorney General, this is Dean. I don't know if you studied or looked at the Wisconsin Club for Growth, the John Doe prosecutions run by state prosecutors there that I think were ultimately under court order suspended. Those were, I think, determined to be politically motivated prosecutions and otherwise unfounded. But I'm not aware of courts intervening with state AGs, but it does raise the question. I mean, if you're subject to a bad faith prosecution as an individual or corporation, what's your recourse?
Yeah, it seems like there has to be some remedy if it's clear that it's a political process as opposed to a real prosecution for wrongdoing. And so, you know, I'm certainly comfortable with there being a high standard, but there's got to be some way, there's got to be some remedy for a company or an individual to find themselves out of the way of a illegitimate, politically motivated prosecution.
Once again, if you have a question, we'll make this our final call for questions. If you have a question, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We do have yet another question, so let's hang in there and take another call. Go ahead, caller.
On the question of dubious bad faith or even unjustified prosecutions, while would there be a recourse afterwards? Is there a way of filing against the prosecutor later on for a bad faith prosecution?
You know, typically there is. You know, it's not my expertise. Criminal law, but typically there is some type of remedy afterwards. The challenge of that, obviously, is the reputational damage, the cost, the abuse, if it is bad faith. And so the question has to be asked, you know, do we have to subject people to, you know, the whole process and then potentially, you know, losing because of that, and then ultimately, you know, you prevail in the end, but you've had to go through so much abuse and reputational damage that it has its impact. So, in my opinion, if we can show that the standard is high and that there is bad faith, it would certainly be more, be more inclined to providing justice to individuals and corporations if we can resolve that sooner rather than later.
That certainly makes sense.
This is Dean again. I agree with that, and there might be cases where you can't prove bad faith until after, maybe even long after prosecution's wrapped up, but that would be the one circumstance where I guess you would proceed afterwards. But otherwise, it makes eminent sense to try and put an abuse of power to rest as soon as you can. We've got two questions pending, so let's carry on with our next caller.
Greetings, General.
Greetings.
Is there any correlation between the prosecutorial standards with the burden of proof and the investigation that leads into it? So if the prosecutor has to go beyond any reasonable doubt, do they have a higher standard in evaluating whether or not there are whether a crime has taken place?
Okay, I don't quite understand your question, so rephrase it.
Thank you. This is a criminal matter that was going on between the attorney generals and Exxon, or at least that was the threat, right?
Sure, that's what the subpoenas were issued under their prosecutorial powers, as opposed to their civil powers, is my understanding.
Right, and if they were looking then to prosecute, at least purportedly, for some sort of violation of whatever it might be. And they have a burden of proof involved in that prosecution, which is far and above just what's in a civil subpoena. Do they have an additional obligation as a law enforcement officer to have more than just a reasonable suspicion or the thought of, you know, more likely than not?
I don't think
when
so.
They're
typically, at least the standard in Texas, you know, they just have to show probable cause, and so to get an indictment. So the challenge of that is once you're there. You know, you've got the long process of digging your way out of this almost presumption of guilt once you've been indicted. So I think that's the concern when we're talking about a political, what appears to be a political process more than a real prosecution. If it's that easy to go get an indictment, probable cause, you don't necessarily have to tell the jury everything. You tell them what you want, what the prosecutors can tell them what they want them to know. And ultimately, you have a long, expensive process that's difficult to get out of, and you have to go oftentimes to trial to try to win your case. And then if you, as Dean suggested, sometimes you don't have all the information until later that there was bad faith. Here, it looks like bad faith from, you know, the outset.
Okay, thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your phone. We've got one question pending, then once again, our lines will be wide open. Let's head in a new direction with a new caller.
Hi, it's Devin Watkins. My question is not necessarily about what current precedent is, because I know that it isn't what the current precedent is, but it seems to me what's being done here is they're trying to basically seize the papers and effects of ExxonMobil to find out some of the internal correspondence. Do you think going forward the Fourth Amendment should be perhaps implicated in this, that there should be some type of probable cause requirement before we allow prosecutors to go seize these papers and effects?
You know, I hadn't really thought about that. Maybe not a bad idea. Certainly in this case, you know, we have New York and Massachusetts have statute of limitations. I don't remember. One of them has a 3-year, one has a 4-year. And it's interesting that they can go back 40 years when the statute of limitations for each state is significantly less. So it seems to me there ought to be some limitation there as well, that they can't go back farther than their statute of limitations goes back.
We've got one question pending. Let me ask a follow-up question here, and that's it seems to me, well, in your brief, you mentioned the chilling effect here, getting back to the speech issue. One thing Exxon did was, as any good corporate citizen, it gave money to various entities, and some of that money went to universities, some to think tanks, some to other sorts of charities. And some of the entities that were subject to subpoenas by various state AGs were recipients of Exxon's funding, charitable funding. I have to say, sort of living in that world, I have to think that those organizations or similar organizations would think twice about taking money from Exxon now for any purpose, for any sort of research or conferences or anything like that, knowing that they too might be subject to closer scrutiny by the New York Attorney General or some other law enforcement outfit. Is that part of your thinking, part of your brief?
Yeah, it's actually one of our biggest concerns. And not only, you know, are people going to take money from Exxon, but then you've got, you know, the other entities like that we were just talking about, CEI, where, you know, if you're a nonprofit and people are giving to you, it may potentially impact your donations. It may ultimately impact Exxon's willingness to give to those types of organizations as well. So it can go both ways. Either way, the government shouldn't be putting people and individuals and entities in a position where their giving and their donations are impacted by, you know, political views, which, you know, one of the stated purposes of this group was to impact, you know, those type of decisions.
Once again, we have one question pending, then our lines are wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your phone if you'd like to ask a question. Let's go to the next caller.
Thank you, General. You've talked a little bit about the think tanks and which are nonprofits. Doesn't Texas have residual authority over the nonprofits incorporated under Texas law? And in that regard, what interest does New York have legitimately in the activities of a Texas nonprofit?
That's a good question. So, you know, there's always the question of what interest we as Texas have in nonprofits. We certainly have interest in nonprofits that are filed in our state. We have some oversight of those. Typically, we're only dealing with that in cases of fraud and issues like that. But then it gets a little more tricky when those nonprofits are in other states. You know, there's sometimes a connection because donors come from our state, but it becomes a little more tenuous when they're really operating other places, unless we can show some type of fraud related to individuals from our state. So, you know, the same. I don't know what the law is in New York and what their state law allows the AG's office or any other governmental entity to do in New York. I just know how it really operates in Texas, and that tends to be, you know, out of our office.
Let me make another final call for questions. A call for our final question. I beg your pardon. Push the star button and the pound button on your phone if you'd like to be the final question of the day. I don't see another question, General Paxton, so it appears that we have had our final question of the day. Before we adjourn, we've got some time left. Let me come back to you and see if you want to express a final thought or summarize in any sense.
Sure. I mean, this obviously is an important issue, I think, not just for Texas. We pursued it because it was occurring in Texas, but I think it's an important issue for all of us to consider. And, you know, as government's grown and as they become sometimes more aggressive, if we're not willing to stand up and say no, even if we may or may not agree with the issue or disagree with the issue, it still ends up affecting free speech and chilling speech, you know, around the country. And so I think it's important for all of us to consider that, whether we, you know, like the issue or not. There's still the First Amendment, and we still have to be diligent in protecting the First Amendment. And it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, one individual citizen or whether it's a large corporation. Once we start losing those rights, it's a slippery slope to government controlling more and more of our speech, and you know, from there we're on a bad slope. So I appreciate the opportunity to share some of this, and certainly feel free to contact my office anytime.
Well, thank you very much, Attorney General Ken Paxton. We certainly appreciate you joining us. This has been a fascinating discussion, and thank you once again for leading us in this discussion. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call. That's tomorrow, May 10th, Wednesday, at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. We'll be talking about President Trump's Religious Liberties Executive Order. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.